Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, episode 144 for February 19th, 2010. I have really big spreadsheet needs. Windows Weekly is brought to you by the new Carbonite Pro. It's simple, secure, and affordable online backup for your small business. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com. And by GoToMeeting, the affordable way to meet with clients and colleagues. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com/WindowsWeekly. And by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/windows. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show that covers everything that's happening in that little town called Redmond up there in the Pacific Northwest, the state of Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, he's a man who spends his many hours observing, watching, and analyzing what happens up there in beautiful Redmond, Mr. Paul Thurrott, who is today in Florida. Hello, Paulie.
Right. I could have been in Barcelona, but I went to Florida instead.
Barcelona is a beautiful city. Yeah. And that's because you'd planned this trip for a long time.
Yeah.
Yes. I'll tell you what. I'll talk like Ricardo Montalban to make you feel better about missing Barcelona.
Ricardo Montalban, the gay blade?
Yes. Perhaps you remember me from such great movies as Zorro. So, in Barcelona, the Windows Mobile Conference, it's a big mobile event for cell phones. We're going to talk about Windows Mobile 7 today. This is the big story, right? I mean, the big story. Paul, some of our listeners are in audio. They don't see you nodding.
They don't see me nodding, yeah.
Paul nodded. Paul just nodded. Jace.
I've only been doing this for 3.5 years.
Jace, he says. Yes, Windows Mobile will find Corinthians.
Don't question my techniques.
No, it will never question you, Paul Thurrott. So that's coming up. We're going to talk about email outages in Hotmail, Outlook. Well, this is really interesting, this Outlook social graph thing they're doing.
Yep.
Maybe that's in response to Buzz. Maybe get your opinion on Buzz, too. On Windows 7 feature of the week, tip of the week. Software pick of the week. I mean, there's just a ton of crap in this show.
it's chock full of crap.
Chock full of nuts. We're going to get to our top stories in just a moment. Before I do want to mention our friends at Carbonite, who do the fantastic Carbonite Pro. Now, you probably heard me talk about Carbonite, period. You know, the great backup solution for consumers. Carbonite Pro is for business. What they found out is that many of their Carbonite consumer users were, in fact, businesses who had an account per machine. Because it's so great. It's so simple. You just put it on the machine. It starts backing up immediately all the personal documents, financial records, you know, whatever key information is on that machine to the cloud using AES 256-bit encryption. So it's completely private. So they said, well, you know, if all these people are using the you know, $5 a month Carbonite regular, we ought to offer a special deal with a centralized management console for businesses. We're going to call it, I don't know what, Carbonite Pro. And there Carbonite Pro was born on that fateful day. Carbonite Pro prices start as low as $10 a month. I'll give you an example. The pricing is variable depending on amount of data, number of computers. But let's say you have 8 computers, 5 gigabytes total backup, $25 a month. 18 computers with 5 gigs, $50 a month. Peace of mind for you and your employees. You have total control of it with a centralized management console. No limit on the number of seats you can back up. Backup status summary, so you know if the backups are happening. Verification, and of course, you can download those files at any computer at any time. There's even an iPhone application for it. And employees can access their own backup files, so they don't have to come begging to you, unless you insist. You can say, I want to know. But I think it's nice for employees not to have to confess that they deleted the spreadsheet right before the end of the quarter. They can go to Carbonite Pro, get it back, and no one's the wiser. You want to try it? Tell you what, I've set it up so you can try it free for 30 days. Carbonite really wants small business owners especially to take a look at this product, evaluate it for yourself. We're going to use it immediately. I signed up. CarboniteProducom. Calm, centralized backup for your entire enterprise, your small business. Very affordable. Give it a try free for 30 days. CarboniteProducts.com. We thank them so much for their support of Windows Weekly. So did you have like a live feed to Barcelona so you could watch this event, or did you have to do, you know, go on the internet? How did you follow this?
They broadcast it live.
Really? Neat.
Unlike Apple.
Unlike Apple. Yeah. That's good because, I mean, as wonderful as Barcelona is, it's a bit of a hike for the U.S.
Yes, it is. You know. Yeah. Well, you know, this is apparently a big mobile show. I say apparently because, you know, until this week, it was never a big deal for me. But, you know, now with Windows Phone 7, suddenly it is a big deal.
Do you think they announced it in Barcelona to emphasize the global nature of Windows Mobile?
No, I think it was just because that happens to be the big show for this market. And when you look at their
there are other shows. There's CTIA. Yep. There are other shows.
Sure.
But I guess this is the big one.
This is the big one, yeah. Yeah, it's really funny. You know, Vista, of course, had a bad reputation. But Windows Mobile's reputation is so bad, it makes Vista look like the shining success story of the decade, right?
And is it really that bad? Yeah. Because it sells well in enterprises, right? I mean, it's got a pretty good market share.
Well, it sells okay in enterprises. I think we talked last week about how, you know, they still had decent market share in the U.S., but that had to be tied solely to enterprises. I can't imagine a single human being walking into a store and coming away with one of those phones.
My knock on it always, even from day one, was it's mm-hmm. just feels like a shrunken Windows.
Right.
And so it just didn't really feel like it was designed for the platform. It designed like it looked to me like it was something kind of stripped down to fit a smaller platform.
That's true, right? That's always been true. Back before it was Windows Mobile and it was still Pocket PC, and before then it was just Windows CE. This platform has always been an attempt to duplicate the Windows UI and the user experience on a smaller device. And it was always a mistake. I mean, one of the early issues they had was with the location of that start button. And in the early days, it was down in the lower left corner like it is in Windows, like it right. was in Windows 95 at the time. And that's fine on a computer, but when you're holding a device in your hand, you tend to hit that spot on the screen a lot by mistake.
Right.
And one of the very first things they found was that, and they moved the start button and the second version of the OS up to the top left. You know.
See, I think a phone shouldn't have a start button, period.
Well, without ever thinking that maybe the start menu wasn't necessarily a good interface.
The whole thing.
But, you know, you have to remember, I mean, back in the day, you know, these early versions of this system were piloted with a little stylus, you know, when you're
right.
clicking on these little things on the screen like you would with a mouse.
Right.
And it seems hokey today, but I was trying to explain to my wife today in the car that, you know, one of the problems with Windows Mobile historically has been the convoluted way you have to go around the UI to get to different things. And that the reason it's like that is because they had been building on top of something for so long.
Right.
That, you know, you can look at a problem today and say, hey, I want to do something really simple like, you know, mark email as read and, you know, move it to another folder or delete it. You know, that type of activity, if you're starting from scratch, can be done very simply and it's done very well on something like the iPhone. But when you've had an email application that literally dates back to 1995,
right?
You've added to it and added to it and added to it. And by the time you get to Windows Mobile 6, you know, it's really convoluted how you go about getting that thing done on that kind of phone. And it makes the experience miserable. So, you know, heading into this show, obviously there have been high expectations for Windows, what we thought would be called Windows Mobile 7. But, you know, come on. I mean, given the high quality of things like the iPhone or Google Android especially, and to a lesser extent, software that is excellent like WebOS but doesn't sell well, or software that isn't excellent but sells well like the RIM stuff, it's hard to imagine, you know, what they could have done to make a big dent in things. But then you see what they did do and you realize that maybe they're actually onto something, you know.
So tell me a little bit about what's new here.
Yeah, so everything is new, which is
really they start completely from
difficult.
Scratch.
Yeah, completely new platform. Literally started over from scratch. You know, the folks that are responsible for this include such people as Joe Belfiore, who was the guy behind, you know, some of the Windows XP UI stuff, the Media Center UI, the Zune UI, the Portable Media Center UI, and what these things all have in common is a a similar way of navigating through information. I'm not actually sure what the right name is. I refer to it and think of it as a crossbar UI, because you can navigate up and down through lists, but you can also navigate left and right through sets of lists, right? And the way they described this in the presentation that where they announced Windows Phone 7 was that this entire thing was essentially a panorama, and that the phone was like a viewport.
So you're looking into like one quarter of the total screen and scrolling around within it.
So if you're familiar with the Zune HD, it works just like that. In many cases, literally, it's just like that.
Right.
From the lock screen that is identical to the Zune HD lock screen to the way that you navigate around different elements. And these lists aren't just text lists. They're often grids of icons, or in some cases even photographic elements that are in rectangles or squares and so forth.
It's funny because this is totally what struck me about the thing is that this is really the influence of Zune.
It is absolutely, yeah. And it's funny because, you know, from a perspective standpoint in some ways, you know, Zune has not been a huge success. But what that hides is the fact that the UIs they've created in Zune are in fact hugely successful.
Right.
They're wonderful. And I've been telling people for a long time that, you know, A, they should give this kind of thing a chance, but also that B, that Microsoft should be putting this UI in everything. And when Microsoft started talking about moving the Zune services and the Zune software to, say, the Xbox, my initial reaction was, this is fantastic, because if they can create this UI type on the Xbox, it's a UI that would make a lot of sense, even with a controller, because it's very easy to move up, down, left, right.
Right.
You know, it's a very natural UI. But, you know, with the phone itself, you know, with the actual Windows...
It really looks like a Zune, I have to say.
It is essentially a Zune. Yeah. So they've done so much right here, you know, I would say.
Well, I wonder why they didn't call it Zune Phone and get it, just be done with it.
Because, again, I don't think the Zune brand is strong enough.
Right.
I think the Zune brand is, you know, is seen as somewhat of a, I don't want to say debacle, but it hasn't done well.
Right.
And certainly it's not something that's sold internationally, and I don't think it would have a lot of pull around the world. But Windows still has a great brand name. It's still very popular.
Right.
People still associate it in very positive ways. So I think just using it, you know, thinking this is the Windows on the phone, to me makes some sense. And I also would just say, for people who are fans of the Zune or people who live internationally, and I get a lot of email about this, wondering, you know, when is the Zune HD coming? And how, you'll recall, I said last year when I talked to Microsoft about Zune HD, the story had changed, whereas in the past, they always had some intention to move Zune at some later date international. But when Zune HD came out, that stopped. And in fact, it stopped to the point where they didn't even want to talk about it. And I think that this phone explains why, because they have no intention of bringing the Zune hardware international. They don't have to. You can get it on this phone. And when the phone is a superset of what's available in a dedicated MP3 player, you can understand where that makes a lot of sense. These phones will be sold by multiple carriers for multiple hardware manufacturers everywhere around the world. So this is how Zune gets distributed.
Is it a unified experience? And this is always a problem with when you do an operating system, and then carriers, they tend to customize it, right?
This is one of those semi-unanswered questions. So with regards to companies like HTC, for example, that creates a touch flow interface that sits on top of another...
We might not get this UI.
Right. Now, I'm not clear yet on how that will happen, other than to say that Microsoft's recommendation is that they don't replace the home screen, you know, the start screen, with their own thing, but rather they create their own, what they're calling integrated experiences or hubs, which are the things that you get to when you click on an icon or a tile on that homepage, so that HTC could create custom, you know, if you think about how touch flow works right now, there's a clock and there's some other stuff, you know, that stuff, there's no reason that a lot of those elements can't just be tiles, right, that would sit on a home screen that the user customizes with their own stuff, right, rather than having a whole separate interface that replaces everything else.
I think this is really beautiful in this, and it is designed for that size screen and touch.
Yeah.
It's just
it's also, you know, it's an interesting rethinking of the phone. I mean, for all of the innovation that occurred with the iPhone, and it can't be overstated. It's a tremendous device. You know, the thing really is a little computer, right? I mean, you have these icons that represent applications, and you launch one, and then you're just doing that one thing. And if you want to do something else, you have to get out of that, go find the other thing, get in. You know, cutting and pasting between those things becomes a little tedious. There's no true sense of multitasking. It's a certain kind of environment. And I think what they're trying to do with Windows Phone 7 is get rid of that notion where the phone has to be like a little PC, right? The phone isn't a PC. It's used for different types of experiences. You know, it is when you're standing in line and you have a couple of minutes to kill and you want to update Facebook or check out what your friends are doing or look at some photos, or listen to music, whatever it is. And rather than have these discrete applications, although there will, of course, be applications, right? I mean, that, you know, we're not just renaming things, but there are applications running on top of this platform, obviously. But there are also these notions of, they're calling them experiences or integrated experiences, which are these panoramic screens that can contain different elements, that can combine information from different sources. And I think it's that integration and that rethinking of what a phone is that makes it really interesting. You know, they coined a word, they use this word a lot, glanceable, which isn't actually a word.
Yeah, it's funny because Apple used the word lickable.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's...
not really a word, but we get it, right?
We get it. Glanceable. You can glance at it.
It's okay.
Yeah, information at your fingertips. Oh, wait a minute,
anyone who has stood in line at a store, you know, waiting to check out or in line at the airport.
They mean scannable. You could look at it very quickly. Yeah,
you have a couple seconds to kill or whatever. Yeah. You know, you look at it, you glance, you see it. So the point of this UI is that, yes, there's an email application. Yes, there's a Facebook application. Yes, there's a, you know, whatever application. There's all these applications. But you can glance at the screen and get this information from them that bubbles up.
I really like that. You know, I think that's a nice feature.
It's smart. And, you know, again, it goes beyond what I thought that they would do. And I think that's what's so impressive about it. It would have been very easy to come out. In fact, they were almost there with Windows Mobile 6.5 to do something that was just like Google Android or just like the iPhone, right? A grid of icons on top of some, you know, palette, and you click on them and you run applications. You have an online store.
I have to say, this feels like a post-iPhone UI, though. I mean, it feels more modern and more glanceable.
And that's why it's exciting, because Google Android, and it's good stuff, but for all of that, what it really is the iPhone, again, just from a different company.
Right.
It's a little more open, well, a lot more open, whatever. But it's the same kind
of thing. Heavily influenced, yeah. It's not a rethinking.
It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's credible for that reason, because I would say before Android came out, and even since, no one else has done that, right? No one else has achieved that level of iPhone-ness, or whatever, to coin another new word. But I think the reason Windows Phone 7 is so notable is that it's not the same thing again. And it seems, and again, without having one in front of me that I can play with yet, it really seems like it works, right? I mean, it just seems right, doesn't it? It seems like the right thing. And it came from Microsoft is so bizarre to me.
Stunning. It's stunning.
Yeah. So I think they deserve a lot of credit for that.
They do. And I think the Zoom team, now it can be revealed when you and I got that Zoom briefing. That was kind of one of the messages of it is Zoom everywhere, right? It's going to be the new media player. It's going to be on the Xbox. It's going to be on, and I don't know if they said Windows Mobile, but boy, that clearly happened.
It was on the phone.
Yeah.
So this also explains some of the rumor stuff that happened a few weeks ago when Microsoft released the Zoom 4.2 software update. Remember, one of the bloggers found some references to new devices in the INI file. What does this mean? Are there new Zooms coming?
Zoom
and
phone.
What it means? Well, they're that's what this is. It's these phones,
right?
So, and one of the things they demoed was, you know, these devices will work standalone, which is also a big change from the past. You know, because it evolved out of a PDA, the Windows Mobile phones were always seen as companions to PCs. That you would connect them at some point, synchronize data between them, and that you would have like this offline cache on the phone and you could do stuff with it. And that's how it would work. So Windows Phone 7 is really designed to be a standalone device. You don't ever have to connect it to a PC. If you do, you get additional capabilities. And one of them is that you can use the Zoom software to synchronize your digital media content to the device.
So this really is like the iPhone, since you've got this media channel, this built-in sync. And it's like Android. This is one of the things I like about Android is you never really hook it up to a computer. It just gets everything over the air. So that's good. It's the best of both worlds. Yeah. You could do it both ways.
Exactly. The other thing they got right, and I don't think they've gotten the credit yet for this, because only Apple, in my mind, has done this, is, you know, Apple has done a tremendous job with their developer tools. And they've created all of the widgets and little control pieces and so forth that you would need for a typical application. Right. Obviously, if you're running a game, you're going to have your own UI and different issues there. But if you're running a typical iPhone application, one of the things you'll notice is they all look and act the same way, right? Mm-hmm. Same button types, the drop-down lists all work the same way, all that stuff. They've done a really good job on that. On the Android side, I don't feel like they've done as good of a job. And maybe it's just the nature of that platform and the types of people who develop for it. But if you look at Android applications, it seems like from a UI perspective, they're all over the map. I'm not saying that Google hasn't created standard control types. I'm sure that they have. It's just that in using the device, one of the things you notice is the applications are all really different, aren't they? I mean, you use one. I mean, have you noticed this?
Yeah, right. They have all different UIs. There's no standard UI at all.
That's the way it seems, yeah. Yep. Now, with Windows Phone 7, they've created a lot of standard UI elements. And then, of course, all the integration pieces. So you can create these apps or app-like services anyway that run as part of these integrated experiences. But there are also these app bar, toolbar type things, which are now standardized across applications. And we got an early peek at that in the version of Internet Explorer that shipped with the previous version of Windows Mobile. And now Windows Phone 7, you see that this thing works across all of the applications. So it works in a very consistent way. And it's a really neat way to do things on a phone because, and this is an area where they go a little bit beyond what Apple does because sometimes the UI can get in the way on a very small screen. And, Apple makes some concessions to that. So for example, in their browser, typically the address bar will kind of pop off the top of the screen. But if you're scrolling down a long web page, that address bar gets further and further away. It's not actually off of this top of the screen. It's way up at the top of the document, right? So if you're familiar with how the iPhone works, you'll understand what I mean by that. But on Windows Phone 7, this app bar is always there at the bottom of the screen. And when it pops up, you get the most common elements, the most common options or commands that you might need for whatever application you're in. But then you can pull it up as you do on the Zoom HD with like the lock screen and so forth. You get this additional area that kind of pops up over the application. And that provides you with more of the advanced options and commands that are available in that application. And what a great way to do that because it's not always on screen. It's not always blocking your way. And even when you do pop something up, what you get at first are the things that most people need most of the time. And if you need access to advanced stuff, you just slide the screen up a little bit further and you get more stuff. So that is just a smart design. And that it's available as a sort of a central element to all applications, I think is really smart. And I think it's another one of those things that's going to make using this phone easier because, as is the case, say, with Office apps, when you've used one, you kind of understand how the UI works and it's easier to use the next one.
Right. This is so funny because this is something Apple kind of pioneered, and proselytized right. for is the unified UI.
Yep. Yeah. No. And by the way, and Apple still does a good job with that. It's still a good job. It's better than what Google's doing with Android.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anything? There's a lot here. I mean,
there is. Yeah.
It's really neat. And all I can say is what I've been doing is the presentation that they provide, where they announce this system, is hours long. It's very long. So I've been kind of going over it in a multi-part series on the site. So I guess what I'd say is I've gotten about, I finished two parts and I'm thinking it'll be three or possibly four parts.
You're live blogging the
re-record. After the fact.
After
yeah.
The so fact it's, video. It,
yeah. Yeah.
That's good.
Exactly
I like it. Right, yeah. That's good. Yeah. Good idea.
Yeah.
So if people go to winsupersite.com, they can see that.
The point here is to, I wanted to do this now before I have a chance to get my hands on it because
first impact.
There's a first impression thing, but yeah. I also, if I had done it live, like literally live, it wouldn't have had the same depth to it because, off the cuff, things aren't as obvious. And one of the things you can do is you write this thing up, you kind of gain a bit of perspective as they go through things. And I have to say, again, Microsoft has never done a good job of making a splash about anything.
Not Apple style.
No. And this is, it's so interesting to see them just hit one out of the park like this. It's so unusual, I'm almost uncomfortable with it. they're like, for example, I'll give you an example. Almost anyone would agree that Windows 7 is fantastic, right? Windows 7 has gotten excellent reviews. Everyone loves it. There's not a lot you can say bad about the thing. But here's the thing. Windows 7... couldn't have existed without Windows Vista. And for all of the dirt that got dumped on top of Vista, the truth is it wasn't as horrible as people said it was. And it really just set the stage for what became Windows 7. I mean, Windows 7 was something, I don't want to say it was easy to make, but come on. I mean, you know, what we have to do is take this thing that's already pretty damn good and fine tune it and call it something different. And people are going to love it because it's not Vista. And that's sort of what Windows 7 is.
Right.
I don't mean to diminish the quality of what's happening there because it's good stuff. There's no doubt about it. But come on, this was something that they had the firm foundation for. It was not that difficult, you know, in the scheme of things. Windows Phone 7 had no, you know, obvious predecessor, although looking at it now, you can say, obviously, the Zune HD and so forth. I mean, arguably, they have, in fact, been working on this over a long, long period of time, even though we didn't really realize, and maybe they didn't realize that's what they were doing. But, you know, the predecessor to this product was so horrible. You know, so absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone saw this coming. It's wonderful that they were able to turn this thing around like that.
When are we going to see these phones?
So they're saying late in the year. I'm thinking October, November timeframe.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of questions, you know, that we still have, you know, backwards compatibility. One of my understandings is that Windows Mobile 6.5 point, you know, whatever. And you may recall, too, we had a conversation around the next version, the next minor version of Windows Mobile. People were calling it 6.5.3 or 6.5.2, right, whatever. And I kept saying, you know, I don't think that's the name. It's, you know, I think of it as 6.5.x. Well, the reason is they're calling it Windows Phone Classic, right?
So going forward, that's a mistake.
They're still going to upgrade it.
They're still, you know, good. Okay.
They'll still do, you know, upgrades like the stuff they've been adding this year around the capacitive touchscreen support and a more unified UI and all that stuff. I would imagine that this thing is going to be shunted off to emerging markets and right, that kind of stuff.
Cheap phones.
That the hardware,
yeah.
Well, you know, there's a higher level of hardware required to run Windows Phone 7 than there is Windows Mobile 6.5.
Right.
So you could run the older system on lower end devices that would be very inexpensive. And maybe that still makes sense for some people. There certainly is a very rich and almost historical API available there for people who want to write applications or whatever solutions that run on those phones. I mean, that's still there. It's not going away. So, I think that, you know, the time is ticking now, right? They've announced this great new thing. It's kind of tough selling the old, you know, the old one when you've got this new thing coming.
End of year, we're thinking.
Yeah.
And all the usual suspects, HTC and Samsung.
Everyone has signed on board, yeah.
Everybody, yeah. Yep.
And now you know why, right? And I even remember, you know, HTC started coming out with the Android phone, some of which were very well received, and you know, people were asking them, well, you're going to dump Windows Mobile, right? And they said, no, we're very committed to the Microsoft stuff. And now you kind of see why. Because
yep,
they were up on this. They worked in lockstep with Microsoft on this stuff. And, you know, they know looking at it, it's good stuff. You know, this is something you want to be part of. So,
well, you know, I'm really intrigued. Of course, it's almost impossible to judge it based solely on the UI. You've got to see if it works, yep, you know, and see how
absolutely
it feels, if it feels sluggish, if it feels fast,
right,
you know,
right,
if it does.
I wish I was in Barcelona because I could have gotten my hands on some of these
right
things. But if you read the reports, people who were there, you know, again, it's one of those things that people are like, wow, this is okay.
Good.
Yeah.
Glad to hear it.
I am too.
Yeah. So there's a couple of other news stories, one of which is not on your list. And I don't know if you've seen this because it might have happened just as we were talking, but our chat room sent it along, a Wired.com piece that says Yahoo and Microsoft have gotten regulatory approval from the Justice Department to do the yep, the search.
Yeah, that just happened. And apparently the EU is getting ready to, okay, what is that picture you're looking at? That's horrible.
Well, Steve Ballmer and somebody from Yahoo, is that Carol Bartz? Must be Carol
Bartz. Yeah, it's like that time that George W. Bush came up and tried to give the back rub to the Chancellor of Germany.
Oh, yeah, that was
good. It's got that kind of vibe.
Steve,
to
what's
it
your hand Merkel doing? Get you, yeah, Ms. Merkel. Get your hand out of Carol's
back pocket.
Back
there,
pocket. Right. What, you know, Steve, well, the part of it, the problem is he looks so happy.
Yeah,
she's enjoying it, too. Wow.
Oh,
and then
man,
it says Yahoo behind them. So
sure,
this is a caption
contest.
Or as
Microsoft now refers to it, the smallest freaking part of our empire. You know?
Wow. Well, no, they just say the Silicon Valley Bureau. that's what I'd call it.
Sure.
We're going to take a break, come back with some big changes to Outlook in the social media sphere. But before we do that, I'd like to mention, if I might, Citrix, the folks who do GoToMeeting. They've got a great backbone for remote access. You know, they do the enterprise stuff. They make a consumer version with GoToMyPC. They've got GoToAssist for the folks who want to help in IT. GoToMeeting is for the folks who are spending all that money traveling for sales meetings, collaboration, product demos. American Express says the average cost of a business trip these days is $1,000 for one trip. That includes airfare, hotel. Does not include the stress and strain of getting in a security line, taking off your shoes and all of that stuff, getting a middle seat on a red-eye flight. See, just eliminate that with GoToMeeting. Save time, save money, save stress. GoToMeeting.com. You can try it free right now. GoToMeeting.com/WindowsWeekly. It'll take you a minute to install. In fact, before I'm done talking, you'll probably have it running. Now, anytime somebody's on the phone with you and you say, I wish I could show you our great presentation. We've worked so hard on it. Or I'd love to show you this, the numbers in this. I've got the spreadsheet right here. Or maybe you would like to try this product out yourself. You can, but not in person. Just use GoToMeeting. Your client goes to GoToMeeting.com and suddenly they're seeing your desktop on their screen. You can give them control, so it's great for training. You could show them. They can even show you their screen. You can flip-flop it. Windows or Mac. GoToMeeting.com/WindowsWeekly for sales presentations, product demos, collaboration, training. There's nothing better. I've tried all the meeting programs. We use GoToMeeting all the time. We were using it last night on our new show This Week in Radio Tech, and it works so great. It's just fast. It's real time. And by the way, you're $49 a month. Compare that to $1,000 for one business trip. $49 for unlimited meetings as long as you want, as often as you want. And that includes voice over IP and phone teleconferencing free. Oh, that's all I have to say. GoToMeeting.com/WindowsWeekly. Give it a try.
So, by the way.
Yes?
Yeah, apparently this Microsoft Yahoo deal has been cleared in Europe as well.
So it's done. It's a done deal.
That's it.
It's over. It's not the beginning of the end for Yahoo, is it?
No, that happened about 5 years ago.
That's the end of the end.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it.
Do you remember, you know, Yahoo was used to have product placement occasionally in movies. Wasn't there a Back to the Future movie?
Oh, wouldn't that be funny?
That was too long.
Talk about it.
There's a movie where they fly through a screen. You know, it's like a billboard out in the street somewhere and it says Yahoo, and they actually make the Yahoo sound in the movie.
Oh,
I don't remember the
movie. It's going to seem so dated in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Oh. The Alliance announced last summer to cut costs and raise revenues for both companies as they struggle against Google. Mm-hmm. Bing provides the list of links for every Yahoo search, now freeing Yahoo, I like that, from the expense of running a huge search enterprise.
Or as we call it, out of the frying pan and into the fire. You know?
Yeah, now Yahoo's going to do the advertising side of it.
I see.
So they have something
to do. They'll be fine. I'm sure what they come up with will be very high quality.
Oh, that's sad. So really, this thing that began over a year ago with Microsoft trying to buy Yahoo for $31 a share.
Right.
Has now...
You know, in retrospect...
That would have been a deal.
It's looking like a pretty good deal, isn't it?
Should have done it.
Yep.
Should have... Well, it took Jerry Yang down, the founder. I mean, he was the CEO.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, there comes a time, I think, in any company's life where the founders are more of a drag than they are a benefit.
Yep.
You know? And I'm sure... In fact, I'm absolutely positive that
that's what happened. It's happening
they
right now.
Twit. Yeah, as a founder, you hate to see your baby. It's right. Happening now with Twit.
Yeah.
Why would
I don't know?
What are you talking?
I feel
about?
I'm being pushed out.
I see. Well, I didn't want to say anything.
I came in yesterday. The ball was actually outside.
Your issue with the stolen strawberries has gotten out of control.
The strawberries were carefully calculated in the kitchen.
Yeah. You need to let go, man. It was we had a good run.
I did not cut that tow line. Outlook integrating with social networking services LinkedIn,
yep.
Facebook and MySpace to come.
Yes.
So is this for all? This is all Outlooks?
Yeah, actually it is. So you made a comment earlier about whether or not this was influenced by the Google Buzz service, but it's not because September, I think it was, Microsoft had a reviewers workshop for Office 2010, and one of the things they told us about was this product and how this is something they were adding to Outlook. So I think it's important to draw the distinction between what Microsoft's doing and what Google did with Buzz, which is that the Outlook Social Connector, as it's called, is an add-on. It's not something that ships in the product. It's an opt-in service. You opt into the various social networks you want to configure in there. Right now it's in beta, as is Office 2010. So I guess as of today or yesterday, you can get a beta version of the LinkedIn plugin, you know, for this product. And then by the end of the first half of this year, you'll be able to get MySpace and Facebook as well. But of course, Microsoft did this. So it's an open... no, it's not an open... I can't believe it. It said the word
open. Open? So, what?
It is, well,
I almost fell off my ball.
Yeah. Sorry. It's so cute that I think this.
That's Buzz. That's Buzz.
No, it's open to third party developers to add support for any social networking service they want.
That's cool.
I kind of make fun of Outlook because it's big and bloated and slow and all that kind of stuff. But it is also the center of many people's lives, right? Because Outlook is that one application you leave running all day long. Because it's not just email, it's all your personal information, your calendar, your scheduled tasks, and all that stuff. So it's a big deal. So if you can centralize this information in there, sort of akin to what they did with RSS feeds a number of years back, you know, Outlook is one of the places where you can get your Outlook, your RSS feeds delivered if you want. And if you prefer to view such things as if they were email, which I do think makes some sense. You know, Outlook may be the place to do that. And if you want to interact with people on Facebook or MySpace or LinkedIn or whatever, it kind of makes sense that you'd want to do that through Outlook. If Outlook is the place where you store all your contacts and you keep track of that kind of thing. So this provides a way to make that happen. Hmm. And yes, like you said, it's interesting. I perceived that this was an Outlook 2010 add-on, but actually it's for Outlook 2003, 2007, and 2010.
So everybody can try it.
Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah, the problems during the beta are a few, but there are a few problems. One is that it requires a 32-bit version of Outlook currently. Nice. Now, that's no problem for 2003 or 2007 because those products are only available in 32-bit. Right. But I actually installed the 64-bit version of Office on my laptop here, so I can't actually test this. It's not 64-bit yet.
Why did you install the 64-bit version of Office?
I don't know. I actually had to go check to see which one was installed. I'm not sure why. I have really big spreadsheet needs. I don't know. There's no good reason to do it. It's not compatible with anything.
Right.
You know, if you
and
want
it gains you little.
If it gains you nothing. If you want the safest browsing experience on Earth, please run the 64-bit version of Internet Explorer.
Oh, to my that's fun. Flash doesn't
there
work.
There isn't a single add-on created for it, so you'd be safe from everything, including the sites you want to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of works like that right now. I expect that to change, obviously, but as of right now, it's a little bit of a problem.
Hotmail outages? I hadn't heard about those.
Oh, before we get to that,
more for Outlook. All right.
We should mention Buzz.
We haven't really talked about
Buzz.
We haven't talked about Buzz. What do you think about Buzz?
I don't like it.
You know? I love it.
Yeah.
But I love everything.
I understand why, but my issue is that I use Gmail, and I can't. I should have done a better job of segregating my work and personal lives, I think. And if I could do it all over again, I would. But right now, I have everything going through Gmail, and I don't really want to risk opening up my my contact list to people I don't know. Right. So in the early days, you know, a la less than 10 days ago when the service debuted, people could get in and join very easily, and there was no real administration of the service. You just kind of turned it on and. I think that they'll get it right eventually. I'm just, in fact, maybe as of today have already gotten it right, but I'm just shocked that a company like Google, and by the way, this is language we typically use for Microsoft, right? A company so full of incredibly smart people could have done something this boneheadedly dumb.
Because of the privacy stuff?
Yeah, it's so dumb. It's so clueless. You know, to think that this made it out into the real world to hundreds of millions of people who use Gmail. And literally, no one pulled the switch on any privacy concerns.
So you were but you personally didn't feel. I mean, okay. So here's the privacy issues, and by the way, these have all been ameliorated within a week of the launch. It's only 5 days old.
But again, I bet to go back to what I said about that earlier. That's like
saying, fixed hey, it ahead of time.
Yeah. Yeah, the bank just got robbed. Let's put a lock on the door.
Right. They should have.
So I'm glad they reacted quickly.
But so I think summarize the privacy issues. One, when you joined, at least initially, they fixed that in a couple of days. It would auto subscribe you to your most active contacts and chat people. And in doing so, exposed their email addresses and names or
their
handles to anybody who wanted to browse you, because you could see who was following you and who you were, who you were following. So that was problem one. Problem two was that your own email address was kind of exposed.
I don't care about that personally. My email address is out there.
You don't. Right? Well, and I didn't really care about either. Now, the new sign up, when you sign up, it's an opt-in thing. They have who they're saying you could follow based on what they know about you, but you don't have to. You can uncheck. Sure. I don't know. I haven't looked at the latest verbiage. I don't know how clear they are about what this exposes, however.
I am not a privacy weirdo. I'm not. In fact, almost every single time some privacy weirdo has written something about something, I thought they were wrong.
Well, there's a class action lawsuit now from
right. Now, in this case, I'm not even sure I would call it a privacy concern, but I'm just flabbergasted that they would release that thing in such a state. I mean, it was just so, it was unconfigurable.
I asked a couple of people on Twig on This Week in Google on Saturday, and their opinion was that it had been used for more than a year in-house, and that it was just wasn't on the radar of the engineers who were using it. They didn't even consider the privacy thing. And you're right. Had they done a small public beta, it would have surfaced immediately.
Oh, immediately. And the fact that engineers at a company like Google said it was okay, I mean, this shows you kind of the disconnectedness that occurs at this company, right? Full of geniuses, no doubt about it.
A lot of engineers. Engineers don't make maybe the best user interface people.
Absolutely. Well, that's for sure.
And they're certainly not good privacy
advocates. They also
maybe
don't make the best decisions in general, you know, just for non-tech issues. You know, I mean, it's amazing to me. Again, this is a big, big company. Nobody thought to say no to this.
And to underscore,
there had to have been a review of some kind. You know, there had to have been a meeting where donuts were passed around and somebody, you know, people
looked at it. It's odd that it got missed.
Yeah.
It is odd that it got missed. Our doctor in the chat room says she uses Gmail to correspond with patients. So signing up for or allowing, and by the way, it was, you know, you kind of strongly encouraged to turn it on. Immediately potentially exposed names or email addresses anyway of patients.
Mm-hmm. It's good stuff.
Yeah,
it's good stuff.
I guess. It's not a huge violation, is it?
I don't know. I'll just speak for myself. I would say this, you know.
I mean, it's illegal. It's a HIPAA violation.
But maybe you shouldn't
be using Gmail for patient email.
I have friends and family, you know, around the country who will occasionally comment to me that, you know, you've got X number of people following you on Facebook and we don't understand why you're doing this and you know, whatever. So they don't live in the world I live in. It's okay for me to do things the way I do things. It's okay for them to do the way they do things. But it's not okay for Google to change something in my account that opens up the way I do things to this other part of the world that doesn't want to have this going on. So I guess my concern is just that it's okay for me to be transparent. It's okay for me to be open. And this is where I am right now. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm doing outside of my work related stuff. If you're interested.
Yeah. Later today, I'm going to give up my genome to the public and my medical history. So some people that's exciting.
Yeah. I'm going to go nuts on that, by the way. But anyway, the point is, it shouldn't affect anyone else.
Right.
You know?
No, we should have to do it.
It's not cool.
Yeah.
It's just not cool.
No, it's not cool. I think Google acknowledges
it. Often, I've said this about people in my neighborhood. You know, I've said to my neighbors, you know, I don't care if you sacrifice goats in your house. I just don't want to see it.
Right.
You know, it's okay for you to do whatever you want to do as long as it doesn't affect other people. You know, and this, when it comes from a third party like Google, I mean, it makes, that's, I think that's maybe the definition of privacy.
Well, especially somebody who is already under great scrutiny for this kind of thing.
Sure. And you think someone like that would be a little more careful.
Yeah.
You know?
Also, Gmail is one of their premier products, and a lot of people complained about all the buzzes in the Gmail inbox, and, you know, it just kind of screwed up their inbox, et cetera, et cetera. And there are ways to fix that.
But again, if you say you like it, and I understand it, and I think if you're in Gmail all day, as someone else maybe would be in Outlook all day, it makes sense in some ways for there to be this capability within Gmail to see what other people are doing, to update your own status and so forth. It's fine. I get that people would like that, but it just, man, it was released in such an unready state.
Well, I still like it. But I completely am sympathetic with anybody who has a privacy concern about it. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's a problem. I'm not gainsaying that at all.
Listen, I blindly okay everything that Google sends me, but this was one of those times.
They made a mistake.
I kind of stepped back and looked at it, and I said, I don't know what this thing's doing.
They're facing FTC investigation. They're facing lawsuits. Yeah. They made a mistake. There's no question about it. Now, getting that out of the way, do you think Buzz has is of any interest as a service?
I don't know. So there are two schools of thought here, right? There's the Microsoft and Yahoo approach, which is to say, look, you know, they're already established players. Rather than try to usurp them, we're never going to do it. Let's just work with them. We'll allow those things to be aggregated into our own feeds and all that kind of stuff.
Well, and Buzz does that, by the way.
No, I know. But in other words, but they don't add their own stuff on top. Right. Well, actually, Windows Live has their own thing, of course, as well. But, you know, Windows Live right now is more about being a central point of your life where everything gets aggregated in. Whereas instead of a replacement for stuff that's already out there. So I guess the question is there room for another service like this? You know, Google's taking the opposite approach. You know, we're going to do our own thing. I mean, Google's revenues are all based on ads, which are based on people using their services. If there are big sites, and there are, like Facebook and Twitter, that are pulling eyeballs away from Google's properties, it makes sense that they would want to compete with that.
Right.
So I think it makes sense from a competitive standpoint. Is there room for another one? I mean, yeah, sure. You know, things change. You never know.
And there's some arguments.
MySpace was a big deal for a long time.
This uses open standards. So, I mean, there's some arguments for why this might be a better choice than a silo like, say, Twitter or Facebook.
Oh, there are no limits, right, like there are in Twitter. You don't have a 100.
And it's open. It's open. You can write, it not only has a great API, but it's using open standards. So,
hey, 2 years from now, we may look back on this and forget there was any uproar.
I think we're in a world where Facebook is basically AOL. Twitter is, you know, these are silos. They're private, closed systems. Yeah. And what Google's trying to do is open them up a little bit and have them interoperate. And I think that that's a good thing. It makes this stuff, this kind of microblogging, a higher level messaging system that's of more value and more global than Twitter to Twitter or Facebook to Facebook. And if you complain about privacy, Facebook is far worse in so many ways.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. Yeah. Facebook's settings, such as they are inscrutable.
Yeah. I mean, they never made this horrendous mistake of exposing people's email to strangers, but they expose your information to marketers routinely, constantly, without your permission and without any way to block it. So, you know, you're not getting stalked.
The only reason I put up with Facebook at all is because everyone is on there.
Right.
Right.
Right. Me too. The only reason I put up with Twitter is for that reason.
Yeah. Twitter to me is semi-innocuous. I mean, Twitter is easy to walk away from.
I give it up for Len.
Yeah. Yeah. You can, that's between you and your God. But I would just say that, you know, it's easy to ignore, right? Facebook is, you know, Facebook has a little bit of a pull to it, right? Because those are people.
However, you know.
You're related to, or everybody's you're very there. Close to, in many cases. I mean, it's an evil, evil little service. You think about it.
Well, that that's my problem. Facebook's the one people should be more. I don't know why people aren't more up in arms about it.
Well, I think you answered your own question. You said it was the AOL of today, which I agree with completely. And what that means to me is normal people use it, and they don't have an understanding of the issues with something like Facebook. If I get yet another pop-up from someone who has completed X level on whatever stupid game I swear to God.
I'm that guy, by the way.
Are you? I block all that stuff.
All my iPhone games immediately tell Facebook how I'm doing.
It's so ponderous. It's so ponderous.
Well, that's Facebook.
Yeah.
What else is there on Facebook?
Well,
that's why I like Buzz,
because
Buzz is higher level conversation.
I go to Facebook just to find out what people that I care about have been doing lately that I don't get to see a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep, yep. Speaking of privacy, I guess this Hotmail outage is concerned that some people a little bit about privacy. How?
Yeah, I was hoping there would be an update to this before we went on the air, but there hasn't been, to my knowledge. So there was a Hotmail outage the other day. This is really funny. Microsoft's explanation was that one of the two servers for this area went down, and the remaining server was just thus overloaded. And I have this image of two, you know, Pentium Pro computers sitting under a desk in someone's office, you know, and someone tripped over the power cord and unplugged one of the two servers. I mean, it seems hokey to me that a service as important as Hotmail could somehow be affected by this, but this was apparently it. The privacy concerns come from the fact that when the service came back up, apparently, some people reported that they were able to access other people's account information.
Oh, that's a privacy violation. Okay.
Yeah. Well, these are still sort of unsubstantiated. So, you know, it's not safe to use a computer, Leo, I think is the message.
Yeah.
To the show.
Maybe that's it. You're on the internet. You know, you're exposing yourself, I guess.
Scott McNeely said, you know, get over it. Your privacy is gone. Right?
Yeah. And then he immediately got purchased by Oracle, and it was true. Windows 7 tip of the week. Feature of the week. Feature. It's not a tip. It's a feature.
Right. So this feature is, I wanted to do a different feature, but I had to hold off. I've got some new information about it.
Oh, you're under NDA again, huh?
Well, I'm discovering something new about the feature I intended to use. But anyway, the feature this week is Windows Anytime Upgrade. This is a feature that existed in Windows Vista as well, but they've fixed a bunch of the problems with it, and it's a lot better than it used to be. And what it basically does is allow you to electronically upgrade from a low-end version of Windows 7 to a higher-end version of Windows 7. And the reason this is important is if you were running a low-end Windows 7 version, like Windows 7 Starter or Home Premium, whatever, and you wanted to upgrade to, say, Ultimate, you could walk into a store and buy the retail upgrade packaging and perform that upgrade. You know, you do an in-place upgrade. It takes an hour or two to perform such an upgrade. The nice thing about Windows Anytime Upgrade is you can do it electronically. It only takes about 10 or 15 minutes to perform the whole upgrade. So it doesn't, you know, rewrite the whole system. It just enables the features that are available in that upper end version, you know, the one that you don't have. You can, in fact, buy retail versions of this product. You can go to Amazon.com or Newegg, I believe, and actually purchase a little box. But all that's in the box is a product key, you know, which is what you get when you buy it electronically. So you just paste the product key in it, and it gives you the new version. So it's too bad that Windows 7, like Windows Vista, has all these different product additions. But at least they make it incredibly easy to do the upgrade. And the reason I wanted to highlight this one now is that this is actually something I've gotten a lot of email about lately. And it seems like people are unclear on the fact that this is available electronically. This is something they experimented with Windows Vista. They took it away in Service Pack 1 because with Windows Vista, it wasn't the entire operating system install disk wasn't copied to the hard drive automatically. So a lot of people who wanted to do this electronically couldn't because the code wasn't available on their computer. So with Windows 7, they changed that. Everything's on the computer already. It's just waiting to be unlocked. So now we can do it electronically. It makes a big, big difference.
I had a listener call me on the radio show who was upgrading from Windows Vista, I think. And he said, I have, you know, Windows Vista Media Center Edition. And I said, you'll be going to Home Premium. He said, well, I want to go to Ultimate. And I said, well, you could buy Ultimate, but what I would do is go to Home Premium, see how you like it. And then this Windows Anytime upgrade makes it very simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to, if you want to turn it on, you turn it on.
It's worth checking out the pricing, too. I don't know off the top of my head if what you just said
might
would
be cheaper.
Right. It might be. You know,
you can buy a 7 Ultimate Upgrade Edition if you have Windows Vista Media Center, and it will work. You can go up like that, right?
So there's no Windows 7 Media Center, but...
Windows Vista Media Center. I'm saying he has a Windows...
No, I mean, there's no... Okay, it doesn't matter. So if you have Windows Vista, whatever, doesn't matter what the version is, you can buy the... You can buy the upgrade version of Ultimate because Ultimate is the equivalent to or greater than any version of Vista. Right. So, yes, that would work for an in-place upgrade.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yep.
Let us get our Audible pick. And then we have some software picks as well. Audible, as you well know, if you listen to this show, is what keeps Paul and me sane. When he's on that plane, that big old jet airliner, the kids are going crazy. There's a woman behind him going, oh, my sinuses. He's got something to listen to. It's his Audible book, and I listen to it all the time at the gym. I hate exercise, but I listen in the gym, and it just goes by like that. In fact, sometimes I want to stay longer on the treadmill because I'm enjoying it. Just started a new book on Audible, and it's always fun when you start a new book. Just really great. And it's always sad when the old one ends, you know?
I don't even remember, months now, I've been going in and out of a Stephen King book, the Under the Dome book.
Oh, yeah.
It's so long, you know? It's awesome, though. And I'm actually finally getting toward the end. And I need badly for this thing to be resolved.
Yeah, sometimes you get a really long one. It's like, okay, you can end now.
Well, no, I don't mean that in a bad sense. I mean, I just want to know what happens now. I need answers. It's like getting to the end of Lost, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I don't need any more cliffhangers. Right. I want there to be a cascade of answers.
The good news is about Stephen King is he is not a weak ending kind of guy.
No, he's not a Neal Stephenson.
Right. There's guys that just say, I've written enough.
He occasionally cops out. I mean, sometimes he'll have this ending where it's something magical.
Yeah, no, you know, that's not good.
Or a completely normal book will suddenly have a paranormal ending for some reason.
No.
He does do that. But, and I'm a little worried about that in this book. But but so far, so good.
Warn us. Well, you got a new Stephen King to listen to now. Yeah, this is exciting. Yeah, that might be another reason to want to hurry through it.
Yeah, so... This story actually dates back to the release of the Kindle 2 about a year and a half ago, and it was exclusively on the Kindle originally because the Kindle factors in to the story.
Oh, this is the one with the Kindle in it. Oh.
Yeah, so it's funny, like, you know, some people have said, well, this is like an advertisement for the Kindle. That's wrong, you know. But it was only made available to people who already had a Kindle, so it's not like he was trying to sell the Kindle.
And I mean, it's a short story.
Yeah, it's somewhere between a short story and a novella. It's a shorter thing. So in the scheme of Stephen King's writings, it's definitely on the shorter side. And actually, you know, again, with the fatigue that becomes associated with the longer books, this might be some welcome relief. But it's called You Are. And I think of it as Stephen King's ode to the Kindle in some ways. And it's got kind of a Michael Crichton, you know, fear of technology vibe to it, which I also kind of enjoy. As did his Cell book, by the way, if you're not familiar with that one, kind of a end of times, you know, fear of technology type book. But in this book, the Kindle factors very prominently and is in fact the gateway to other worlds and other realities where the lives of authors that you know went a little differently.
Take that, iPad.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, who knows? You're not a gate to another world.
Yeah.
That's funny.
So, it's good stuff, and it is very short. So,
You Are, Stephen King, Holter Graham narrate. I'll play a little bit. You know, I haven't played audio from a book. You can get this free, by the way, while we're setting that up, just by going to audible.com/windows, audible.com/windows, and the first one's free. You'll get the gold account. This could be it.
Or, if they were lucky, personal assistance to men of power. The Lady Meerkats had won 8 conference titles in the last 10 years. The coach was Wesley's ex-girlfriend. Ex as of 1 month previous. Ellen Silverman was
A good reader
that had moved Wesley to
really adds meaning and understanding to it by their phrasing, their pacing. And that's one of the reasons I love Audible. They just have the best readers. That sounds good. I can't wait to get it. You Are is the title by Stephen King. Unabridged, 2 hours, 20 minutes. It's a shorty. You want something longer, Under the Dome, another great Stephen King novel. Look, they've got it all.
Under the Dome is fantastic. It's a great book.
When I first joined Audible in 2001, they had just a handful of Stephen Kings, and it was very disappointing to me because these are great novels for audio. But now they got everything. I mean, they've recorded or had recorded everything.
Yeah, my earliest audiobook experiences were Stephen King books, but they were on cassette.
Right, me too.
Long, long time ago.
Loved listening to The Stand on 800 cassettes. That was something.
Exactly.
And that was
like the
experience.
Floppy version of Windows 95.
Yeah. So if you go to audible.com right now, audible.com/windows, It could be yours for free. Sign up for the Gold account and one book a month, which is really great. And I think you're going to love Audible. Plays on the Zune. Plays on. It'll play on your Windows mobile phone, I'm sure. Certainly, yeah. It'll play on your all your Apple stuff, your Kindle, and all of that. Audible.com/Windows. We thank them for their support. Ready for a Windows 7 tip? Paul's got one.
Yes, this one's from Daniel A. White. Thank you for that. It is how to customize pinned taskbar shortcuts. You know, there are certain applications that need to be changed in some way. Maybe you want to always run them full screen, for example, or you want to run them as administrator, which is something I have to do with, say, Visual Studio. If you want to run Visual Studio against a local web server, you have to run it as administrator. What's interesting, though, is when you have things pinned to the Windows 7 taskbar, or if you have an application running, so it's on the taskbar, you can't right-click that thing and do properties like you used to, because when you right-click it, what happens is it brings up the start menu. So how do you change the properties for the application that's associated with the button? It turns out that what you need to do is locate the application name in jump list, right-click on that, and then choose properties. And then you'll get that familiar dialogue where you can do things again, like run, you know, maximize, run minimize, you know, run as administrator, all those options that were available before. So if you're kind of wondering where they went, they're still there, and they are accessible from the taskbar. You just have to know to access them off of that application's entry in the jump list.
Clever, clever. A wise, wise man.
Wow.
Just trying to add a little drama to the show.
I'm trying to figure out what that is. It's like a Jackie, no, not Jackie, geez, Jackie. It's like a, it's, what's that? Oh, God, it's like the number one
kind
son.
Kind of like Alan Rickman a little bit, I was thinking.
Yeah, okay.
Clever.
Okay.
You're clever, Paul Thurrott. Maybe a little too clever for your own good. And now, our tip of the week.
This one has absolutely nothing to do with Windows, but I just thought this was neat. I spend a lot of time looking at flight prices online and all that kind of stuff. So I've always been very attracted to the latest services like Faircast or Yapter or whatever that at the time offer something that's not available elsewhere, you know. And there are two very interesting newish services, one of which I'd never even heard of before until very recently, that offer some interesting ways to save money online when you're traveling, essentially. But the best one is fly.com, which is your basic flight aggregator. So if you want to look for cheap prices on flights, you know, fly.com is a great option. But the other one is called Momondo. Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah, Momondo.
Yeah, look, you should look at this site. It's really interesting. It's similar to Faircast in that they don't do price prediction per se, but they will give you a bar chart of what the prices for the flights look like over different days, so you can pick and choose plus or minus.
That's kind of neat.
Yeah, and the presentation is really kind of cool, actually. But they'll give you they'll look forward over time and say, you know, you want to do this 5 days of travel. Well, here are you can see on this bar chart what the cheapest day to leave is, and then you can look at the bar chart for the return flight, and you can see what the cheapest day on the way back is.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, I don't see you don't see it where you're looking now, but we actually
it's up here. I assume after the search is done,
it will fill it. Yeah,
yeah.
It's literally a bar chart, you know, for each of the flights, and you can kind of see where the low ones are.
I probably shouldn't have picked Las Vegas because you know there's so many flights. Let me do another one because I need to go to San Antonio. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Austin for South by Southwest. So let's do San Jose to Austin.
This one is actually a European company that does this, and I believe that they have a bunch of low-cost European, if you're going to Europe and you want to fly within Europe, it has a bunch of low-cost airlines in there that you wouldn't typically get on your...
Like Ryanair and stuff that. Yeah, yeah. So I think we're going to... When are we doing that? I think that's... April 9th I leave, and I come back April 12th. Oops. All right. There's the departure, and then...
So you can view it in calendar mode, but there's also... See, for some reason, what you're doing is not working, but as I look at it...
I hate it.
I see wonderful charts.
It's just still working. That's why. It's thinking.
I've already brought up three different flights in the time. I don't know why.
You're kidding.
Yeah. No, it's working great over here.
M-O-M-O-N-D-O. Yeah, Momondo. Mm-hmm. And they have hotels and cars and city guys, too.
Yeah.
I'm stopping the search just so we can see the results.
So for whatever reason, the flight you've tried, of course, the
is the same price no matter when.
Right? So the chart is not great. But depending on the destination, there's some dramatic differences.
And sure.
Yeah,
it's good to do that to check, yeah. Because, you know, it's funny because Expedia is cheaper than cheapair.com. You'd think cheapair.com would be the cheapest, but no.
It's not. Well, you know, it depends. I don't think that any one service is always the best. So, obviously, what you need to really do is use a bunch of different ones if you're booking a flight and go back and forth and just find the best deal you can.
Cool. Momondo, our tip of the week. And now, our software pick of the week.
Yeah, so this is a follow-on. You remember last week we recommended ESIS Partition Manager, and one of the issues with that program was that it didn't work with 64-bit versions of Windows. So Raymond Airy wrote in and told me that there is a free partitioning program called Paragon Partition Manager 2010 Free Edition. It's not quite as full-featured as ESIS Partition Manager, but it does work
fine
on 64-bit versions of Windows, which are great. So.
Yeah. Wow. So it works on 64-7.
Yes, there are different versions for 64 and 32-bit versions, yeah.
So is this a come-on for a paid version? I mean, this is free. What's the deal? Non-commercial use
only. Yes, there is an update.
This is great.
Yeah.
paragon-software.com. And that concludes our broadcast day. Paul Thurrott.
Actually, I believe it's only the beginning of your broadcast.
It's beginning of mine, but you're in Florida, and you probably want to go to the beach with the family and enjoy this fine Florida weather.
Leo, it is freezing here.
It's kind of bitter irony.
It's a coat when I'm outside.
You're kidding.
No, it's not.
Where in Florida are you?
We're south of Tampa. I always forget the name of this town.
It's Florida. Maybe you're like in Vermont.
I feel like I'm in Quebec. You know,
maybe you're in Montreal, Florida.
I'm gonna go to the Ice Palace tonight and have dinner. It's been cold.
Well, watch the Winter Olympics and you'll feel warm.
I know,
at least a little warmer. Paul Thurrott is the editor in chief of the Supersite for Windows, winsupersite.com. Editor, news editor of Windows IT Pro, and his new book, Windows 7 Secrets, is everywhere. From Wiley and Sons, it is on Kindle. It is paper, not an audible version yet.
Yeah, I don't think it makes sense for an audible version.
No, I don't think so either. Paul, a great pleasure. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time on Windows Weekly.